The Business Hub on Star Radio.
Good morning and welcome to The Business Hub. My name's Anne Hawkins and this is the region's only commercial radio business show, a show with one goal in mind, to help anyone in business succeed. On the show this week, we have Vernon Spencer, the director of Visual Planet. Visual Planet is a manufacturer of Touchfall, which is a large format touchscreen for interactive displays. And the business has been manufacturing here in Cambridge for about 16 years. So it's unique in that, I think. And then we follow with David Cushman, who is the author of a new book called 10 Principles of Open Business. A very, very interesting read and all about why customers are demanding more of businesses and what the businesses need to do about that. After the break, we have Gary Mumford of Insight Associates, and he's talking about, should I run a company car for me in my business? Gary loves his company car, I know he does, and he looks into whether it's financially beneficial to run a company car for yourself when you also own the business. So that's going to be really, really interesting. And then we follow with David Smallman, who's going to be giving us a very powerful segment called Purpose. We've got some really, really interesting guests lined up this week, so let's crack on with it.
The Business Hub on Star Radio.
First, we're going to go into the interview with Vernon Spencer, who's going to be talking really about why he decided not to take the manufacturing of his company offshore. Good morning, Vernon. Thank you very much for joining us on The Business Hub.
Yeah, thank you, Anne.
Vernon, tell me a little bit about your background and how Visual Planet came to get started.
Yeah, my background is I'm an engineer by profession. Back in the 70s, went through a formal apprenticeship, travelled overseas using that knowledge. Came back and realised that computing and computing science was the way forward from an engineering discipline point of view. Went off to Bristol University, studied CAD/CAM and robotics, and then really progressed from there, got into the software industries. I was fortunate enough to be right at the embryonic start of the CAD/CAM industry, which was based here in Cambridge. Worked for Cambridge Interactive Systems at Harston Mill. During that phase, learnt a lot, got taken over by American companies, progressed my career in that organisation. Then I was fortunate enough to really get at the start of something really exciting as well, and that was the internet industry here under Peter Dorr at Pipex. So that's the background. Spent a tremendous, 7 years with Pipex, which got gobbled up by a number of American companies, and just got disillusioned really with the whole acquisition piece. So having laid out the foundation for the network, I realised that there was a part that was missing, and the part that was missing is actually how do you get your data and your information to a consumer? And that was really where Visual Planet was born. The proposition really was to my wife in June 2001, and she was so excited by it, she challenged me to start a business.
So what was it that you said to her that made it so exciting?
Well, actually, it was walking down Regent Street here in Cambridge. I walked by and we had a bit of time to kill, was going to the theatre. And I just painted a scenario on a piece of glass and said, what about if I could touch that glass and get the dress that I wanted, and I could change the colour, and I could put the shoes on it, and I could swirl it around, and I could find out how much it was, and I could play around with it while I was in the window. I was just killing time, really. I have a lot of ideas, as my wife says. We went to the theatre, had a great evening, came back, and for the first time ever, I was into the land of Nod, and I get a big elbow in my ribs later that evening, and she obviously couldn't sleep that evening, and she challenged me. She said, can you really do what you just said you could do today? I said, nice. At that stage, I was probably disorientated, and I said to her, What do you mean? She said, that idea you told me, you know, when we was walking down Regent Street. I said, yeah, sure, of course it can be done. Because the reason is I was more interested in getting to sleep. Anyway, long and short of it, 6 months later, when the time came to move on from the company, then I wanted to move on. The challenge wasn't there anymore. She was the one that said, that idea you told me about 6 months ago. She said, that was such a winning idea, go for it. And on the January 2nd, 2002, I sat down at my desk at home and wrote the business plan, and that's where we are today, 12 years later.
Wow, that's just such a lovely story. It's great, because there are thousands of people out there who have those ideas and they don't do anything with them. So it's great to see that, you know, with a little bit of encouragement, you actually turned it into a fantastic business.
I think you do. You need, there's no doubt about it, you need your partner's engagement and, you know, that backing, because I don't want to say it was a bed of roses, you know, that first 2 years, you know, it was tough, but it was always a belief that it would happen. And and the other part of it is making sure you've got a good network and the right sort of people that you're working with. And I was fortunate enough to work with a great guy at UUnet, and he came on board with Visual Planet about a year later, Mike Cole. So together we've really generated the business and moved it forward.
I've just had an interesting conversation with someone about how a business should be funded. How did you go about that? Did you have you know, a good cushion of money, or did you have investment? How did it all work?
Well, I was fortunate enough to be senior in the last organisation, and we had a fundament for falling out, really, in terms of strategy. By that stage, I'd lost all my resources on a local level, and they were being gradually taken over by American managers, so it's going to be extremely difficult. So there was a lot of morning conference calls and various things were going on, and eventually I said, look, you know, the strategy is not right for this business. So there was a sort of basically a falling out, and so I was fortunate enough to get a sizable package out of that. And rather than, you know, the usual things, pay off the mortgage and you know, and all those other things, it was a once in a lifetime opportunity with a big sort of chunk of money to say, well, actually, let's give this a go. So Visual Planet really was born of self-financed, and you know, we're proud to say that in 12 years of business, we've always generated cash in the business from our customers, given the growth in the business. So we've never been to a bank. So when we went through this last few years, it was it was fortuitous. So we didn't beholden to the bank anyway.
That really is a very unusual story, but a great one if you can manage to grow a business like that. So the idea of the business was born here in Cambridge. Where do you actually do your manufacturing for the screens?
Well, yes. So in the early days, we created a whole new category of touch, and that was the real issue. So in the early days, we had to be all things to all people. So we went out, we actually did the manufacturing here in Cambridge on a small scale to service our own requirement. So we then delivered that to local companies. When I say local, that's UK-centric, but within a matter of weeks, we went from being a local focused business to all of a sudden we got inquiries all around the world for the products that we had developed for our own use. And it soon became apparent that we had to move from a solutions based business into a manufacturing based business. So we were only about 2 years into the business, and we started off manufacturing, and we manufactured here in Cambridge. And we stuck by manufacturing in Cambridge, even though we had lots of offers, certainly from the Chinese and everybody, to manufacture overseas. But we stuck by it. And the reason we stuck by it is because, I suppose, some fundamentals. It's all about disciplines. In our world, we have to develop something. We put R&D in, develop it, then you move it on through the various processes and eventually actually manufacture it. And if you break that link, you start to lose those skills and you can't react so quickly. So it was a fundamental belief that we had that you had to have manufacturing locally. And it's paid dividends for us in the right sort of way, is because our lead times are far superior to any competition that we have. That means because we've got manufacturing locally here, we can react, and we've built a whole bespoke manufacturing facility, which is what, you know, the UK PLC are talking about the ability to be reactive to customer needs. And we've already built that as part of our plan.
Could you have made more profit if you'd gone abroad and used cheaper labour?
Well, there is an argument to be said for that. And I think some of the constraints that we do have in the UK is the high cost here, not just labour, it's the taxation system, it's real estate infrastructure. But, you know, if you plan right and you get the right audience and you sell the value of what you're trying to do, then no, you can rise above that. And even now we're seeing that a lot of people I speak to that have traditionally offshored are now starting to onshore again. So that, and some of the reasons they play back to us is logistics and freight and timelines. Certainly some, even the component manufacturers are starting to ship their manufacturing back to at least Eastern Europe, if not back to the UK. So people are now starting to onshore again.
So it's a decision that you made at the time and you're proud that you made, and it really worked for you.
Yeah, I think I'm very proud. And the reason I'm proud is because if we're 34 people strong at the moment and we're growing, we've just taken on another four, and we see tremendous growth in the business now. And we've got some really global companies that are buying our product. We can't, you know, in our the nature of our business is people don't always want to promote our product, so it's used all around the world, but we can't shout about it.
Oh, that's interesting. So is that for security things? And
no, I think it's brand, and people want to be perceived as doing it themselves. There's okay. Lots of retailers out there that use our product but present it as theirs. There's big global manufacturing organisations that outsource to us, and big software houses. So we our product is in a lot of areas that we you know you wouldn't know about, and we can't shout about.
Okay, so you mentioned retail. I'm not going to embarrass you by trying to sort of wheedle things out of you, but you mentioned retail. So might we see your products on phones and tablets and
no you won't
touch screen?
No, the fundamentals of the business are all based around digital signage, and this is creating a whole new category. Right at the beginning, digital signage didn't exist in its form when we started the business. So we focused around digital signage. And what that actually means is you see our product on very large screens in large applications. So you wouldn't necessarily see them on tablets or mobile phones, but you'd see them where you walk up to a railway station and you want to know when the next train is, or in a retail store where you want no more product information. So it'd be that area.
So, and buying tickets and all that kind of stuff,
yes.
I guess. Yeah, yeah, okay. That's been absolutely fascinating. Where do you see the future of your business and this type of business? You said it's in a growth mode. Where is it going?
Oh, I'd love to have that crystal ball. all I can say at the moment, all the market research is telling us that the consumer wants information, and they get it through tablet, they get it through mobile phone, and they get it through other devices. So we can see that this is a continuing trend, and certainly the market research indicates to us that there's still huge growth potential in this whole industry, at least for the next 7 years. So who knows? But certainly what we want to be is a dominant player in our particular market niche, and make sure that our products are out there delivering that type of solution.
You mentioned that the people who use your products don't necessarily promote you. So how do you get known? Do you go to trade fairs and this kind of thing? Is it that type of promotion that you
need
to
do? Well, I think historically, people that needed to have interactivity knew about us. So in that sense, people, even in our industry, it's quite a relatively small industry on a global basis, even though there's a lot of activity going on out there. And in that context, we're known about as a manufacturer. So to a certain extent, that helps the process. I think going forward, not get too down, but obviously there's certain sector areas, like retail and transportation that we probably could do a lot more in by talking direct to organisations that are in those markets, which we traditionally haven't done. So that's probably where we will put a lot of effort next. Rather than into our peer organisations and people that know about us, we will actually start talking to organisations that don't necessarily know about us at this moment in time.
Vernon, it's been an absolute joy to talk to you, and just so interesting to hear about a company that started in Cambridge and actually manufactures here. It's not the most obvious place in the world to start a manufacturing company, but it's great that it's succeeding and growing. Tell people where they can find you, your website, and I know you're on Twitter and Flickr as well.
That's right. So our website is www.visualplanet.biz or .co.uk. And you can find us on there. And we're based here in Cambridge. If people need to telephone, it's 01223 202 949.
Okay. And I know you're on Twitter at Visual Planet Limited. You have a Flickr account, and
yes.
You also have a YouTube channel.
Yes, we've got a number of channels, because obviously trying to explain our product is very difficult for people, so looking at the visual form is very useful.
Okay, so lots of different ways for people to get in touch with you, and we'll put all your details on the Star Radio page on the podcast too. So thank you very, very much for joining us this morning. It's been a real pleasure to listen to your story.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you very much for inviting me.
The Business Hub on Star Radio.
Lots of great tips there from Vernon about how to build a business without getting into debt, without having investors, and to keep the control entirely to yourself, and also about keeping manufacturing in this country, of course, which is always a good thing. So now we're going to lead on with David Cushman. David is also based in Cambridge. He's an author, but a consultant who's been working in the social media field for many, many years, and has some really interesting examples of companies that are taking a totally new approach to business, including Tesco's. So, good morning, David. Welcome to the Business Hub show.
Thank you for having me along.
David, start us off by telling us what the whole idea of an open business is.
Okay, well, the book talks about 10 principles of open business, but the definition of an open business is one which brings people together around things that they have a shared belief in, or they care about the same thing. And so the role of a business is to discover people who care about that thing, to bring them together, to surface what they actually want, and to work with them to make that thing happen. And at its guts, if it's a simple line you want to stick in your head, it's the art of making partners of customers. And I say that because there's a lot of talk about customer centricity. People are always talking about how they want to put the customer at the heart of what they do. What I think they generally mean is they want to put the customer at the heart of what they do something to. So you're doing something to the customer if you're doing the customer-centric thing. If you're making a partner with the customer, the relationship changes quite significantly. You don't treat a partner in the same kind of way as you treat a customer. You have their best interests at heart. You're very much trying to build trust with that person. And those things are really important, particularly in the world that we're in with the digital economy, and being able to connect with each other and being able to discover when organizations do things that we wouldn't like them to do. That's all very widely and easily reported now, because we all have the tools and technologies to share what we think and to call people out.
David, what's your experience? How did you come across this concept and how it's been developed? I'm really trying to figure out not what your credentials are, but kind of what your experience is of working with companies that are buying into this concept.
So I started out in traditional media. I noticed quite early on, through the use of blogs, etc., around 99, and getting involved myself in digital development, that that was a world that was getting disrupted by the way in which the tools of the web are allowing us to come together around things that we care about and make a difference on those things. So it was quite early for me that I noticed that change was afoot. I joined a social media agency and started working with large brands, large organizations, essentially initially all around social media marketing. And it struck me even then that there was rather more to this than a cheap way in which we could get marketing done. It seemed to be much more a way in which you connect people, and the best way ever that we've been able to connect with our customers in particular in a business context. So taking those things on board, we set up, my business partner and I, Jamie Burke, who's the co-author in so much as he's certainly the co-author of the principles. We set up this business called 9010, which was a management consultancy in open business. We decided that we wanted to make a distinction between open business and social business, which some of your listeners may have heard about. Social business for me is a little bit too focused on the tools. So selling you technologies rather than working out the behaviours first, and then trying to help you select the right tools to match those behaviours. And also social sometimes has some meanings that are not altogether positive in the boardroom. You know, people might think it's all a little bit too hippie and idyllic to talk about social rather than open. They see that aligned with open innovation and those kinds of ideas, and that seems a much more business-focused way to think about it. So we started working with some quite large organisations on a multinational footing, initially to help them understand what people were saying about them and what they might learn from that. And over time, developing strategies to open them up, to find places in which, through all of their processes, their customers could become their partners, to the benefit of both parties, of course. So from that, from doing that for that consultancy we ran for 3.5 years, it was only right at the end of that that we actually codified these things into a set of principles. And once we got the principles, it then became a really empowering way in which you could create change. Because in the book, you'll find that each chapter ends with a summary and a goal state, a kind of description of the worst case scenario you could be in this particular principle and the best case that you could aim for. And readers are invited to score their organization between those two. And if you do that across all of the principles, you'll be able to identify which of the things you're weakest in and which you need to act fastest and first on. So it becomes very much a way in which people start to act. And in each case, we've got a few examples of the first steps you can take to help you on your journey, for example, to transparency or to a journey to open innovation or to a journey to open capital. So it's become a way in which we can take a lot of theory, and there's an awful lot of theory learnt from doing, but at the end of the day, a lot of what we've done, very practical, because we've actually done it in the real world with large organisations.
That's a terrific explanation. Thank you very much indeed. There are two companies in particular, very, very different companies, that I read about in your book. One is Tesco and one is Giffgaff, and they couldn't be further apart, really. So tell us how companies like that can both benefit from adopting an open business principle.
Well, Tesco's is particularly interesting and intriguing, I guess, to many people, because their story is one that surprises people, because we have the chief marketing officer, Matt Atkinson, is the guy who wrote the preface for the book. And so he's a big fan of open business. And I remember going into Tesco 3.5-4 years ago, not long after he joined the organization. And before I'd sat down, he said to me, "We want to be an open business." And he was using the language that I'd been using for a long time and clearly been a follower of what we've been doing. But Tesco chose to spend an awful lot of money with some very large management consultancies on a global scale, some guys in California, some guys in Denmark, some guys in New York. And after they'd spent all the money, they came back with an answer that actually everyone I tell this to goes, "Yeah, of course." And the answer was that they weren't trusted and people didn't like them. And you know, we all knew that in the streets. Everyone knew a story about, you know, a friend who'd been a supplier to Tesco and how predatory they had been with them. And yet people in the business itself, in Tesco itself, were not like that at all and didn't feel they were like that at all. And it came as a real shock, a real surprise to them. So that came about the same time as they were also, for the first time in their recent history, had taken a little bit of a judder in their growth rate. They'd slowed down. The profit rates had fallen for the first time in 20 years, I think. So all in all, they had reasons to listen and reasons to change. And the change that they chose to go for was this very open business approach. It was also the fact that not only Matt was into it, so was the new CEO, Philip. So you had that driving force from the top, and I think that's very important, particularly in very large organisations, that there is belief right from the top. I don't think this can percolate from the bottom necessarily. It's great that everyone believes in it and goes on the same journey, but it's much more powerful if you have got the guys who can make the changes at the top. And what they've done is, you can go to Tesco's PLC site and take a look at this for yourself, but they've now come out with these very powerful principles. And principle one of open business is purpose, having something to believe in, because that's a real motivator for your whole journey. It'll attract people to you. It'll get you out of bed in the morning. It'll attract customers to you. It'll attract the right customers to you, those kind of things. And Tesco's come out with three really big kind of societally changing purposes that are nothing to do with, on the face of it, making money. They've also, if you take a look at it, they've got this big idea going through everything they're doing now, which is using our scale for good. So they're understanding that you can't play a role in society as a large business and just be exploitative and just be about making profit. Because not because that's going to get you brownie points or make people smile and think you're a lovely green business or anything like that, but actually because it hits the bottom line. Their purposes are around healthier people, people with better life chances, like kids getting into employment earlier, and reducing waste. And I think Matt used a line to me which I thought was interesting. the idea that half the world is eating itself to death while half the world is starving, and that's insane. And they want to do something about that. They want to use their skill for good to do stuff about these things, but they don't want to do it alone. And that's a really important part of an open business, is that you become a platform to bring other people together to help you achieve these big, ambitious goals. Now, at the end of the day, the reasons they are doing this stuff, if you look at it in a hard-nosed business way, is if you haven't got a society with economically viable people going forward, i.e. getting kids into jobs, reducing waste, all of those things, you don't have an economy in which a Tesco can function. You've got to have a future and a wealthy, viable future in order for a business like Tesco to have a strong future. They're finding they're having to do all this stuff to rebuild trust, and they're having to do it in a very open way, because you can't build trust behind a closed door anyway. And they found that that's the thing that had gone away from them. People didn't trust them anymore. So now Matt is talking about becoming a partner, not a predator, with supply chains, with customers. So having customers' best interests at heart is not just about giving them the lowest price anymore.
That's a really, really inspiring and heartwarming story, David. Thank you. Could I just ask you to talk about GiftGaff for a moment, because it's such a very different proposition, isn't it?
Yeah, GiftGaff, I think, of all of the businesses I've spoken to or been involved with, is the one that ticks the most boxes for open business. It manages most of the principles, not all of them, but most of them at a pretty high level. And for those not familiar with it, GiftGaff is a mobile phone operator. Essentially, it started life just being as distributing SIM cards, and you got all your customer service. It was all done online. You couldn't buy a phone from them. You could just get a SIM card. And all of the customer service, bar a very small amount that's available via also online, but for transactional stuff, like credit card identification, those things, everything else is dealt with by other customers. So it's a peer-to-peer customer service environment in which you earn points and kudos for doing good service to other customers, which you can then cash in towards buying your next airtime or internet connection time. So they've got a nice model going there. They also have a very open innovation model where your ideas are valued, and they get thousands of ideas, and they have a neat way of surfacing them so that every idea that reaches a certain level of support gets reviewed by the senior team, and it either gets acted on or you get an explanation for why it wasn't acted on, and there's sometimes circumstances why you can't. Every price rise, every sometimes price reductions are discussed with the community. And I mentioned this, I think, to you beforehand. There's an interesting thing that they have on every desk in the office there, which is a little honk honk horn. And it's there to remind everyone that we're not talking about customers. You're never to talk about a customer in GiftGaff. It's always you are a member at GiftGaff. So if anyone says customer, you pick up the horn and do the honk honk noise to remind them. So they've kept this idea that the member rather than the customer is important. And that's a very, one of the principles of open business is member-led, or you could call that customer-led if you're not used to the member notion. But it's the idea that you are led by customers rather than simply trying to get them to do stuff. And that's much more aligned to being a partner. So you can see that through the GiftGaff notion. If GiftGaff is going to do something that impacts its members, it will discuss that with them, and it will get their vote. And if they say we're going to put the price up, they'll explain very clearly why, and there'll be a big, actually a quite high-level debate about the ins and outs of price increases and data charges and who they're buying their data from and all of those things. And they get an amazing level of buy-in from that. And I think one of the really powerful measures of their success in this is in trust. So obviously, that's been one of the big things we've seen fall away over the last 10 years, is trust in brands and organisations and governments and police and all the rest of it. And so rebuilding trust is actually at the heart of what the 10 principles is about. It's the 10th principle, trust, but really is the output of all of these other principles, of all of this work that you would be doing. to make partners and customers. So in Giffgaff's case, they scored their trust versus O2, who actually owned them. And O2 have been around for, I think, 11 or 12 years, considerably longer than Giffgaff. I think they've been around about 4 years. I might be wrong on O2, it might be longer than that. You would expect, therefore, and given that O2 spent around $1 billion on marketing, that the level of trust in O2 would be significantly higher than in this upstart Giffgaff. But it's not the case. It's actually the case that for current customers of Giffgaff versus current customers of O2, the level of trust in Giffgaff is higher than in O2. So you could say that this partnership model for them has been worth £1 billion. And given them this huge step forward in time it's taken to build that equity in the brand.
That's quite an astonishing story, really. And you've managed to give us, to wrap up in that story, some of the principles of open business. We're rapidly running out of time here, and I'm sure we could talk for a long time about this. But yeah. Just very briefly, tell me, which of the principles do companies find it hardest to adopt?
Yeah, I think there's two that are scariest for them. Open capital is very challenging to those who are used to getting their money from traditional sources. So open capital is this crowdfunding idea. And I think it can make more meaningful businesses because people put a bit of their money into it rather than just click the like button. They might care about that thing. They've proven that they care about it. And actually, they're buying their way into the team. They're going to support you going forward. So it's a really powerful piece of the puzzle, but it's one that I think large organisations, because of institutional investment, etc., that's a challenge for them. And they may have to work at that as being separate kind of external units where they experiment in those ideas. So there's that. The other is actually one that's really embedded in open business. And, you know, if I said to you what is open, transparency aligns most immediately, comes immediately to mind. And transparency is tough for outfits that are used to secrecy. And we're built, mostly big organizations are built from a default of being closed. If they've got one little piece of information in the business that is meant to be kept secret, that seems to infect the rest of the thinking. So I always think of Iron Brew, which has famously got, I think it was one person, maybe two, to know the recipe for Iron Brew. So that's a really important secret. It's like the core of the whole business, so that's fine. Keep that secret. But what happens here in many cases is that the equivalent of an Iron Brew secret in your business becomes, it infects the way we think about all of our information. We start locking it all away. And, you know, we have filing cabinets with keys on and password protected computers and all that stuff because we think there's some massive value in something that we've got secret from other people. Whereas the reality is, and what we're finding with more and more open approaches, that, you know, I hear it time and time again from people who have gone the open route, that they know the risks. They know that there might be a risk that, say, you know, in Giffgaff's case, they know that if they start talking about in their community that they might be doing a price rise or a price cut even, they know that there are members of that community who are probably from rival organisations. They're not stupid. But the risk of them doing something about it and trying to head Giffgaff off and pass or you know, challenging them in some way is much lower than the benefit that they get from being open with their customers about it and the buy-in that they get as a result and then the advocacy that they're building and the trust in their business that they're building. So it's weighing those two things up. In all the cases I speak to, the guys who've gone the open route say we always get more value from being transparent than there is risk in it.
David, I'm very reluctantly going to have to draw the interview to a close now, but I'll end by just urging anybody who's interested in this to go and to go to Amazon and buy your book, The 10 Principles of Open Business, to connect with you on Twitter at David Cushman, and to also find you on LinkedIn where they can see your background. You know, I'm looking forward to the day where you come back onto the show and tell us about some more examples of people who have adopted these principles and are really, you know, trying to find a better way of doing business, but still one that makes profit. So, David, thank you very, very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Anne.
The Business Hub on Star Radio.
Fantastic interview with David there, and I really love the idea of companies having to change because customers are really expecting more of them these days. We're going into a commercial break now, but when we come back, we'll be speaking to Gary Mumford of Insight Associates, and he's going to be talking about whether it's a financially viable proposition for business owners to give themselves a company car.
The Business Hub on Star Radio.
Would your business benefit from a helping hand? Some straightforward, impartial advice from an internationally respected consultancy business based right here in Cambridge? Of course it would. Pathfinder Team Consulting are business specialists who can assist companies in developing new ventures, as well as providing expert advice and solutions for all businesses as they expand or downsize. And with a fee structure that is fully inclusive, with no hidden costs, Pathfinder Team Consulting can offer the support your business needs without burdening it with costs you can't afford. For contact details, visit pathfinderteamconsulting.com and let's work together.
Roger's company was successful, but with so many competitors, he often wondered, could it be even more successful? Then one day, he had a chance meeting with Native Brand, a marketing company based in Cambridge. Using brand positioning, marketing strategy, design, and online media, they could help make the identity and story of his company really stand out. Roger was impressed. Native Brand. Building brands, telling their stories. Go to nativebrand.co.uk and let's arrange a cuppa and a chat.
Did you start your business because you had a passion for something? Do you feel you're spending less time doing what you enjoy and more time getting bogged down with daily finances and accounting? If you can relate to this, you may not realize there's a simple, no-fuss solution. Outsourcing your accounts to Insight Associates will give you more time to run your business, do what you're good at, and add to its value with quality financial information. As a proactive member of your team, you can trust Insight Associates to take responsibility for all accounting roles, from bookkeeping through to your own finance director, and all at a similar cost to employing just one person. Call now on 0800 180 4265 and begin your journey to freedom.
While you're growing your business, who's watching the kitty? Ah! Call Insight Associates now on 0800 180 4265.
Have you considered recruiting X-Forces personnel? Want to know why service leavers are right for your business? Contact Forces Recruitment Services today, your local specialist representing one of Britain's best trained workforces. Our mission is to find you the right person with no charge until the operation is complete. Recruit the best. Visit forcesrecruitment.co.uk.
Growing your business and protecting your brand and reputation while time and money are in short supply may seem like an impossible mission, but like Star Radio, you must stay ahead of the game if your business is to thrive. That's why we've chosen Conscious Communications as our public relations partner. A few things you should know about Conscious Comms. They have big brand experience and give solid objective advice. They really know how to make things happen and have loads of creative ideas. They've proved that great PR and marketing doesn't have to cost the earth. Why don't you go to the website www.consciouscomms.com to see how the team can make your mission possible.
At the Cambridge Fruit Company, we don't care when it rains because we're out delivering boxes of sunshine to the lovely businesses of Cambridge 5 days a week. Call Cambridge 425 308 or visit cambridgefruitcompany.com and we'll deliver our yummy fruit boxes to your workforce. The Cambridge Fruit Company, delivering direct to your business, 100% fresh.
The Business Hub on Star Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Business Hub. My name's Anne Hawkins, and this is the region's only commercial radio business show, a show with one goal in mind, to help anyone in business succeed. We've had a couple of great guests on already. If you've only just tuned in, you can catch them on the podcast later. But now we're going to crack on with Gary Mumford of Insight Associates, who's going to be talking to us all about company cars and whether business owners should give themselves a company car.
The Business Hub with Insight Associates on Star Radio.
Welcome back to the Business Hub, Gary.
Thank you, Isha.
Have you enjoyed your four-day week that we've just had?
Oh, yeah, that's right. It didn't feel like one, though.
No, I know, it never
I think
does.
You end up cramming 6 days into the four or something, don't
you're
you?
You're playing catch-up constantly.
Yeah, it never works, really, does it? But no. It is nice to get a break.
Yeah, good. I see this week we are talking about company cars.
Yes, the ever-emotive subject of company cars. I thought this was worth touching on again, actually, because in particular, looking at whether, when you're running your own business, whether it's appropriate and the best thing to run a company car for yourself. through the business, because it's actually a very, very complex position, and it's definitely worth looking at if you're interested in that, to see whether it's financially beneficial to run the company car for yourself or not, because you're probably going to be running a car one way or the other. So do you run it in the company or don't you run it in the company?
Why is it complex?
Well, it's complex because there's two aspects to it that you really need to consider in detail. I mean, if you consider just for a moment, if you're only an employee of a company and you're not the owner and you draw a salary and you have no other financial interest in the business, then actually a company car is actually quite a simple thing to think through. Because if you're offered a company car, you have to weigh up the tax cost of the benefit in kind, the benefit that you'll be taxed on of having the company car, against what it will cost you to run a car yourself. It's as simple as that. The fact you're paying tax rather than running a car, don't think of it as tax. Just think, well, that's the cost of me having that car. And you need to consider the whole picture, because the chances are if you're given a company car, you're having a company car, it might be a new car or quite a new car, a newer car than you might have otherwise have bought. You're taking no personal risk with that car. So if it goes wrong, it's the employer's responsibility to sort it out. They've got to insure it. They've got to do everything else. They've got to keep it maintained. So actually, in many respects, it removes all those responsibilities away from you. And as I say, the chances are you might not have bought a new car or a car as good as a company car that's being offered to you.
Mm.
And you're in calculating the personal cost of running a car, you need to make sure you remember all the things that it costs to run a car. Because I think if you actually add up how much it costs to run a car yourself, you'd probably be quite horrified.
Mm.
It's not just the cost of the servicing and the insurance and the road tax, but it's also got to think about how you're going to fund it, the depreciation on it. It's almost certainly going to be worth a lot less the day you come to sell it than when you bought it, and the list goes on. So you've got to take all those factors into account and consider that against how much you'll be taxed for having the company car. Very simple question, really.
Mm.
Is it worth having it? Do I want it? Are all the non-financial considerations outweighing that as well?
Mm.
The whole thing then becomes hugely more complicated and much more difficult when it's your business that's providing you with the car, because then you have to consider the implications on the business of providing that car as well as the implications on you of receiving it. The cost of running the company car, the benefit to you of running the car in which you'll be taxed, is one thing. Then in the company, that is an expense which can be deducted from profits. So the costs that the company incurs in running the car and providing the car to you, majority of those can be offset against tax. So therefore, it's a benefit to the company because it's paying less tax. You're paying more tax, the company's paying less tax because it's got those costs. And also, chances are the company will be able to reclaim VAT on various aspects of the costs of running that car, like the servicing costs,
mm-hmm.
some part of the fuel costs. Remember, we covered that a few weeks ago. We were talking about the VAT on fuel. And there's various other aspects of the cost which are actually more efficient if they're inside the company than they are if someone's paying for them personally. But the other side of it is that because it's a benefit that's being provided, the company will also have to pay what's called Class 1A National Insurance, which is actually what's happening. The system is basically saying, instead of paying this person's salary, you're providing them with a benefit, and therefore the company still has to pay National Insurance on that as if it was paying salary. So there's an extra cost in the company of that National Insurance. So you've now got this rather interesting situation where you've got to balance these two things, because you've got to consider the cost on yourself and what the implications are on yourself personally, against where the company is and what's happening in the company. And also, you've got to take into account the fact that if you didn't have a company car, then you need to presumably pay yourself an income out of the company in order that you've got the money to run your own car. I told you it was complicated.
I wish I'd never asked.
So there's a lot of numbers to crunch.
Yeah.
But actually, depending on circumstances, it's definitely worth doing it. To consider where you are.
I see what you mean. So there's really two things that you need to think about. Is it worth paying the tax on the benefit of the car if this is less than the tax saving in the company?
Yes, because then you're paying extra tax on the benefit, but on the other side of the equation, the company's saving more tax than you're paying. And actually, you've got to, I know you really shouldn't think of your own business as being part of you, but in thinking of this, you've got to balance those two things out.
Yeah.
So you really have got to look at that. And, can the company gain more by having the cost of running a car in tax terms than you'll end up paying in extra tax because you've got the benefit. And the VAT can be a key part of that. It's all taxes. Mm-hmm. You're not just talking about, you know, the corporation tax against the income tax. You're also thinking about the fact that the company can reclaim VAT. So as I say, you really do need to sit down and work it through. You might need some help to do that and consider all the factors. And also, you've still got to consider things like how the car is going to be financed, where the money's coming from to buy it, and the depreciation of the car over the life of it, because that's all going to be a factor in this. You know, if the car's in the company, it's the company that's taking that depreciation cost, that hit of that cost, not you personally.
Mm.
So it's not necessarily, it's definitely not a black and white thing. I can assure you it's quite involved. And again, as I said before, the other factor which is often forgotten in this is to considering the consequences if you don't run a company car, because you're still going to need to take the income out of the company to give you sufficient money to not only to live, but also to run a car yourself.
Mm.
So, you know, there is two elements of this. You're going to be taxed on taking money out of the company so that you can go and run a car. You're being taxed because you're having a company car. So it's looking at both scenarios is actually quite important.
All depends on the costs and things of the car that you go for.
Yes, it absolutely is. The cost of the actual car itself and the expense of running it are key factors in working this out. As many people will probably be aware, company cars are now taxed on the original list price of the car at a percentage, and that percentage is determined by the CO2 emissions from the car.
Mm-hmm.
So the tax system was changed some years ago now to try and drive people to consider the efficiency of the cars that they were running, because obviously it's not so much the case now, but still a very high proportion of all the cars on the road are run through companies. So there was no incentive really to make sure that those cars were efficient, and it has definitely pushed motor manufacturers to become more and more efficient in their cars because of the way in which they're taxed when they run as company cars. So at the moment, that percentage can be anywhere between 5% and 35% Wow. of the original list price, depending on what the CO2 emissions are. So, you know, those two factors are key. How expensive is the car originally? Even if you're buying a used car, it's still based on the original list price, not the price the company paid for it. And how environmentally friendly it is will have a huge impact on the number. And it's interesting because generally, what's been happening is that cutoff point of where perhaps it might be better to run the car in the company as opposed to personally is getting lower and lower, because each successive year they increase those percentages. They're pushing them further back down. So if you had a car with a relatively sensible sort of level of CO2 emissions, each year your tax is going up because they're increasing the percentages every year.
Mm.
So a lot will depend on those factors as well, and you need to watch it. Even if you've made the decision, you need to watch it in subsequent years. But what we've really found now is that pretty much, depending on circumstances, the number of miles you're doing, particularly the number of business miles you're doing, are all factors in it. But generally, unless the car has got a CO2 emissions figure which is in a pretty low hundreds now, it's not going to be efficient to run it through the company.
Mm.
Because of the way it's taxed. So you go out and spend a huge amount of money on a very expensive car and you're taxed every year at 35% of its value.
Yeah.
The numbers are big.
And the original list price.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, but if you go back down to, you know, a more sensible car that's very fuel efficient, some of these hybrid cars, which, you know, electric and all that sort of thing, then the numbers get very, very small, and actually it can work. And it can work very, very well. So that's the way the system is very, very focused on trying to drive you down that route. Which makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so it's clearly important to get this right.
Absolutely it is. And as I say, it is a complex calculation and it does need crunching and it does need thinking through. And then, you know, you need to, as I say, keep reviewing it, because what was the right decision at the beginning isn't necessarily the right decision two or three years later.
Mm.
If you decide to keep the car for a few years, it's substantially depreciated after two or three years, and then the equation's different. So it might have been the right thing to run it as a company car initially. If you kept it and it's 3 or 4 years old, it might not be the right decision anymore. And you need to review it again. And if you get it wrong, it can cost you quite a bit tax-wise. So it's definitely worth thinking about. But if you get it right, you can get a huge benefit from it.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
So you need to be on your toes, I think.
Well, Gary Mumford, thank you very much for joining us again and delivering another very, very informative segment. If people want more information, they can go to your website, of course.
They can, insightassociates.co.uk. Huge amount of stuff on there, but we've got a whole section for the Business Hub, and you can read about what we talked about today and look at it and get in touch with us if you're interested in learning any more. Be very happy to help.
Fantastic. Gary, thank you very much.
Thank you. The Business Hub on
Star Radio. So thanks very much to Gary Mumford of Insight Associates. Now we're going to continue with David Smallman, and he's going to be talking to us this morning about purpose.
This is Smallman on Star, making sense of business.
Well, a very good Sunday morning to all of you, and thank you, Anne, for that introduction. She's got some great guests on this show today, hasn't she? Had Vernon Spencer. That was very fascinating, all about his large format touch screens for interactive displays. Obviously, the way everybody's going to be going. It's amazing how many things you come across today in business when you're travelling around the world that are now touch screen. Walk up and touch the screen and it'll fire up in front of you. Amazing stuff. A couple of good things about this week's business, of course. The budget deficit had been dropped by nearly 6.5%. That's the lowest level it's been in 5 years. That's fantastic news. And the other piece of information which came out this week, which I loved as well, was that the orders placed on factories have expanded in the last year faster than at any other time in the last 20 years, nearly 20 years. So that's a fantastic feeling for those folks out there who are in manufacturing. I want to read you a piece that somebody sent me on Thursday morning. And in the middle of this piece that I was sent, the young man who sent it says, "Today I sell my first business. I sell it for the right reasons, to the right people, for the right price, and at the right time. How do I know that? Simply because I do. Arrogance, you might think, but actually not. Not even confidence. It's purpose. I've done what I set out to do. There was a reason, one that I now see. I can think that there's not one person who came into contact or was part of the company that didn't benefit from it. Please forgive me. I'm not talking about clients here, although we've helped thousands of other companies to complete daily tasks within their business. That wasn't my purpose. This is not about a successful business. It's about successful people. Yes, you've guessed it. Successful people create a very successful business." As Max Bygraves, the famous entertainer in the 50s and 60s, would have said at this point, I want to tell you a story. 15 years ago, a young man tried to commit suicide by throwing himself into a river. He failed. At that point, he went on a pathway that led him to sobriety and to rebuild his life. In the last 15 years, he has seen many changes in his life. He's seen the birth of 3 children, become happily married, and 9 years ago, he set out to build a business. He built a business in an industry which is notorious for being extremely hard and one of those which is difficult to break into. In 9 years, many people came through his hands. Many people came and went from his business, and he built it slowly but surely. And a few months ago, he was approached by a much larger company within the industry, and they offered to buy him. This is rare in the industry he's in, but they did, and negotiations set out. After a considerable period of due diligence and a lot of questions, a sum of money was agreed on to purchase the business. As he said in his note to me, it was for the right price at the right time. To come from where he was 15 years ago through all the difficulty of rebuilding your life from a very low point, to sell your business at the age of 40 for a considerable sum of money is a huge achievement. Not only is it a huge achievement, it's an inspiration to all of those of us who think we can't make it, it's too tough, it's too difficult, we won't get there. Oh yes, you will, if you really build the success of successful people. And how do I know that this story is true? The young man in question is one of my sons. Good morning.
The Business Hub on Star Radio.
Thank you very much, David. That's it for this week's show. Thanks again to all of my guests, Vernon Spencer of Visual Planet, David Cushman, author of The 10 Principles of Open Business, Gary Mumford of Insight Associates, and David Smallman talking about purpose. We'll be back next week. And don't forget, you can hear the show again on the Star website, star107.co.uk, and download the podcast if you've missed any of the previous shows. Thanks very much for listening. Have a lovely week, and we'll talk to you again next week.
The Business Hub on Star Radio.
Everyone loves a good story. Whether it's a first chapter or a few volumes, every business has one to tell. And in today's competitive marketplace, it's important to tell yours well. Native Brand can do just that. From brand positioning and marketing strategy through to design and online media, we have the people and experience to ensure your story stands out from the crowd. Native Brand. Building brands, telling their stories. Go to nativebrand.co.uk and let's arrange a cuppa and a chat.